to that with respect to which they dissented, to become thereby no longer dissenters. These are the most creative, but of course they are not thereby jobless, for their very spirit is to move on to new tasks and new challenges. Our speaker today has had a multitude of such achievements. To his credit, I need mention for you only four such projects to indicate the scope and importance of these things: the Miami Valley Conservancy District, the founding of what we know proudly as the New Antioch, the first chairmanship of the Tennessee Valley Authority, his establishment of Community Service Incorporated to press the concept of the importance of the small business and the small community, and do let me have a fifth, his work on behalf of the Commission for Higher Education of India, which, though it did not receive immediate acceptance, has continued to be the foundation for new germinal efforts in that great country. I've mentioned these different types of dissent in order to say this: one needs to listen in a different way to the different kinds of dissenters. To the one who has a complaint but no recommendation, one needs to hear the complaint but move on with his own effort to seek a recommendation. To the man with both, one needs, if he is convincing, to move on to the question, and how do we bring it about? To the man who has accomplished all three kinds of things, we need to listen not only to the ideas, but through and behind them to the man, to the way of performance. For there is a depth of understanding to be found there that no words can quite convey. And we need to listen, so to say, to the man as well as to his words. I have the honor of presenting this kind of creative dissenter on this subject, our beloved Arthur E. Morgan.
Because of the circumstances of our country today, before coming to my subject, I am going to read the last small part of Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. It is for us, the living, rather to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they, thus far, so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. If the sounds which have come from the direction of the college are true echoes, and not incidental static, it seems to me that expression of dissent on specific issues has not been entirely absent here. And that being the case, I think I shall spend my time this morning not in adding to the discussions of those particular dissents, but to speak of the nature and the significance of dissent in general. Dissent is a natural and inevitable part of life. As incurably social animals, men can survive only in complex networks of social relationships with individuals who vary greatly in many ways and in their needs and desires. Their actions affect others for better or worse. They tend to please or displease each other, to help or hinder each other, to collide with each other. As a result, human life and society are possible only by controlling and channeling human relations in ways which will make interaction tolerable and helpful. In living together in one family, one community, one country, or one world, such constant adjustment is imperative. Yet we know by long experience that men and societies cannot live together without some degree of freedom of action, and they cannot thrive unless that degree of freedom is very considerable. Here is the human dilemma. The necessity for control and the need for freedom. Our methods for dealing with that dilemma have been often inadequate. That inadequacy is hinted at in Professor Bridgman's little book, The Logic of Modern Physics, a little classic which has held its position for 25 years, not only in the field of physics, but in general thinking as well. Brigham makes his keystone to be what he calls operational thinking. One wishes he might have chosen a more obvious term. By operational thinking, he means the process of arriving at ideas or concepts through experience, which concepts are then examined and appraised by reference to other experience, rather than by reference to a priori concepts. He puts it this way: to adopt the operational point of view means a far-reaching change in all our habits of thought, in that we shall no longer permit ourselves to use as tools in our thinking concepts of which we cannot give an adequate account in terms of operations. In some respects, thinking becomes simpler because certain old generalizations and idealizations become incapable of use. For instance, many of the speculations of the old natural philosophers become simply unreadable. In other respects, however, thinking becomes more difficult because the operational implications of a concept are often very involved. Then Professor Bridgman, for a moment, turns aside from the field of physics to speak of the general world of thinking. He continues, "Operational thinking will at first prove to be an unsocial virtue. One will find himself perpetually unable to understand the simplest conversation of one's friends, and will make himself universally unpopular by demanding the meaning of even the simplest terms in every argument. Not only will operational thinking reform the social art of conversation, but all our social relationships will be liable to reform. Let anyone examine in operational terms any present-day discussion of present-day religious or moral questions to realize the magnitude of the reformation awaiting us." That's the end of the comment by Bridgman. As an example of what Bridgman refers to as the speculations of early natural philosophers, we might take the preamble of our own Declaration of Independence. We hold these facts, we hold these truths to be self-evident, and so forth. Where could one find a more compact assemblage of non-operational concepts? Take, for instance, the expression inalienable rights. In operational thinking, that term, to use Bridgman's phrase, is simply unreadable. The same is true of the natural philosopher's concept of liberty, as used in the Declaration. In operational thinking, the word rights does not refer to some absolute given man from heaven or inherent in nature. It connotes, rather, man-made practical criteria set up by fallible men to reduce human discord and to favor human fulfillment. The concept of human rights as fallible creations of fallible men is subject to continual or repeated redefinition in accord with growing and changing human experience and with increase or decrease in discernment in appraising the implications of experience. This is true also of the concept of liberty as used in the Declaration. The endless effort to modify social controls and the conditions of human freedom in order to meet the desires of men and of society is the growing edge or the battlefront of humanity. Whoever tries to change or whoever openly expresses disapproval of the prevailing and approved patterns of social controls is a dissenter. Dissent inherently is neither good nor bad. It may express any purpose, from what would be most helpful to man or society to what would be most harmful. The dominant controlling urge of the biological and evolutionary process is survival. This is inevitable for the obvious and conclusive reason that those who do not have that urge tend not to survive. It tends strongly, though not universally, to be true that an individual has the best prospect of being acceptable to society and of surviving if the recognized values of the society he is in are similar to his own. There is a widespread tendency for a person who is a misfit in his society to try, sometimes openly, sometimes covertly, to discredit those personal and social values which are in contrast to his own. If he can do that, his position will be more secure. Observing the near universality of this inclination, I am inclined to the opinion, not arrived at by adequate operational thinking and observation, that this habit has both cultural and genetic basis. In my early days at Antioch, we had a few students whose habit patterns, in some respects, were markedly different from those we were endeavoring to maintain. It puzzled me at first that some of these students were not content to pursue their own divergent courses, but actively propagandized for those divergent elements of action. Then it dawned on me that they were taking the nearly universal course of trying to promote a culture pattern in which they would be acceptable and accepted. For 50 years past, I have noted that one can fairly well estimate the habit patterns of a newspaper reporter by the obituary articles he writes about persons who have reached an advanced age. If the deceased has survived to old age while practicing socially disapproved habits, which are also the habits of the reporter, the public will be amply advised of that fact. From the time I was about 14 until I was about 20, I worked from time to time as a laborer in road gangs in harvest crews, and in lumber camps, largely among men who, in their personal habits, were far below publicly accepted standards, which is a mild expression. By and large, there was only one other subject of conversation which was so steadily and so monotonously pursued as that of discrediting the publicly approved standards. There were two or three general approaches to the subject. Most commonly, it was held that other people were really like the members of the gang, except that they were hypocrites, that their claims to different standards were pretense. A typical expression was, put a roof over this town and you'd have a whorehouse. Another point of view was that substantial means had been acquired dishonestly and need not be respected. The boss stole my bread. Why should I not steal from him? Another basis for discrediting publicly approved standards was that those who did actually live by them were persons who lacked virility, that they maintained those standards only because they did not have vitality enough to have impulse to act otherwise. The idea that a person of strong drives, mastering his own life, seemed not to exist. Here we had the essence of dissent, expression of disapproval of presently accepted and prevailing standards, with effort to discredit those standards and to change them to conform to the standards of the dissenter. These cases might seem to imply that all such dissent is undesirable. That is not the case. The classic Greeks had a rigidly, religiously held dogma that a man must avenge a wrong does to his family, even though that should require him to kill his best friend. Effective dissent from that code would have been wholesome. How are we to distinguish? The best course I know is that which Professor Bridgman calls operational engineering. In another element of the population, there was a different kind of dissent. In many or most communities, there are families or groups of people whose patterns of life are more exacting than those generally accepted. These people constantly try to transcend the current standards and to bring to prevail what they consider to be a finer way of living. They carefully condition their children to these more exacting standards and to build in them habits of self-direction and self-mastery, or in some cases, habits of persistent action in accord with their conditioning. They are taught to be in the world, but not of it. This also is dissent. It has been one of the chief ways by which, through the centuries, patterns of personal and social life have been raised to higher levels. Yet, not all such dissent is productive. Here is a case I give on the authority of Charles Kingsley. At a time when Egypt was Christian, there was teaching that sex was inherently evil. Those who dissented from the evil ways of the world retired to monasteries and nunneries until, according to Kingsley, more than half the population of Egypt had thus fled from worldly evil. In this situation, operational thinking would have brought realization that the course taken was eliminating the element of the population which was most sensitive to exacting standards and was ready to practice self-mastery. Human biological drives have been hundreds of millions of years in development, are very deeply embedded in genetic makeup, and in general are given up very slowly. often too slowly to adjust to changes in the environment. It is estimated by students of evolution, I had considerable correspondence on that point a few years ago, that for every species of animals which survives through its posterity, hundreds or probably thousands of species have failed to make the necessary adjustment and have become extinct. Nature sometimes seems to bungle the job of evolution. Our ancestors who had acquired reflective intelligence began dimly to see that biological evolution moves too slowly and that intelligence and purposefulness could do better by developing more suitable objectives, attitudes, and methods. Julian Huxley stated recently that cultural evolution proceeds many hundreds of times as fast as biological evolution, and therefore constantly enlarges the gap between them. Through the centuries, men have come to challenge the adequacy and value of some biological drives, and have tried to establish what they consider to be more effective and productive controls of action. To a very large extent, the systems of laws, morals, customs, and codes of human action are efforts to control and regulate, or in some cases to eliminate, these very ancient but stubbornly persistent biological drives. Those of our ancestors who first began to reflect and to challenge the authority of our animal impulses, were they not the first dissenters, rebelling against what seemed like the blind fumblings of nature and the intolerance of biological compulsions? They had a very difficult problem, and we must respect their perplexity. Their course lay not in generally accepting or generally rejecting the authority of animal impulses. We cannot live without those. If I am thirsty, I should drink. If I am weary, I should rest. It is only in certain respects that biological drives are bad guides. The course of descent had to be tentative and discriminating for long periods by men who only vaguely understood their problem. Therefore, the descent from servitude to biological drives has been perplexing, though imperative, as seen in the troubled course of laws, manners, and morals. The characteristics of that descent have changed and will continue to change as the insight, experience, and circumstances of man change. Our own branch of the human family, in the effort to explain the persistence of obsolete or otherwise undesirable inborn drives, invented the concept of sin and temptation, with a devil to administer the arrangement. Until the concept of evolution threw light on this conflict between slow-changing biological drives and the more rapidly evolving cultural concepts and aspirations of men, the very nature of the conflict was a perplexity. The Apostle Paul, in the Epistle to the Romans, gives expression to that complexity. He wrote, "The good that I would, I do not, but the evil that I would not, that I do. Now, if I do what I would not, it is no more I that do it, but sin that dwelleth in me. I find then a law that, when I would do good, evil is present in me. For I delight in the law of the Lord after the inward man. But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind, and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members. O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this body, the body of this death?" If in Paul's letters, in place of the word sin, we use such an expression as unsuitable biological drives, the passage becomes quite intelligible. Paul developed an answer to his tragic position, but it was an a priori answer, not fully in accord with operational thinking, as Bridgman defined it. The basic elements of human culture, those elements in which through centuries many men have slowly and painfully, to some degree, freed themselves in appropriate respects from the servitude of biological drives, those elements of social achievement are passed on from generation to generation, chiefly by informal human contact, much as the mother tongue is passed from generation to generation almost unconsciously. The most precious parts of that cultural inheritance, those dealing with goodwill, human sympathy, integrity, dignity, a spirit of fellowship, along with self-discipline and most ethical traits, are mostly transmitted in the intimate relationship of home and community. If those relationships, for any reason, should be broken, then the very qualities of humanity, along with inborn capacity of intelligence, which chiefly distinguish men from other simians, would largely disappear. If those relations are greatly reduced and restricted, then the vitality and the quality of the cultural tradition may greatly suffer. I repeat that, fallible though they may be, those cultural elements are the most precious treasures of the human race. Few, if any, elements of that cultural tradition are of greater value and significance than those by which we maintain freedom from servitude to undesirable biological drives. Under present conditions, there is great reduction in the intimate relation of family and community. This change has been accentuated by the enormously increased flux of populations, which also may cause reduction in the transmission of the cultural inheritance. With the weakening of the transmission of the cultural tradition, which is a marked result of present trends of the social structure, ever-present biological drives are still there, meet greatly reduced competition or restraint, and are widely being embraced as cultural liberation. There is a kind of dissent which almost inevitably appears when, for any reason, established cultural patterns are weakening. Those, especially at the ages during which life patterns are fixed, who have not felt the discipline involved in becoming free from undesirable biological drives, may have a sense of freedom. What commonly occurs, however, is that the ancient, unrelenting biological drives take over. What is achieved is not liberation of the personality, but a return to the biological servitudes from which men through several thousand years have been trying to free themselves. The condition is somewhat like that of an alcoholic who, deprived for a time of his bottle, on getting it again, has a sense of liberation, whereas, in fact, he is only celebrating his servitude. That form of dissent from the cultural tradition has very, very large and important implications. Here, as elsewhere, human insight and judgment are fallible and call for constant re-examination. Among the elements of the cultural tradition, there is much which will not survive the processes of operational thinking. In some cases, cultural traditions are sterile and harmful, and liberation from such is good, as would have been the case in Egypt at the time I have spoken of. But operational thinking is arduous. It is much easier to rationalize our compromises and our surrenders, and to call them liberations. But it is time to come to my announced topic. What is creative dissent? Who is the creative dissenter, especially from the standpoint of operational thinking, or thinking from experience? Creative thinking usually involves imagination. But what has that to do with thinking from experience? This is a crucial point. Commonly, the creative thinker works at his problem by thinking from experience. The difference between him and the mediocre man is that he observes more penetratingly and with greater exactness than do most men. Especially, he is sensitive to inferences. Then, very often, the answer or some element of it comes to him in a flash. He takes this sudden intuition, which is sudden only in outward appearance, and tests it by operational thinking, that is, by further experience. That process, sometimes more, sometimes less formal, may break through barriers of conditioning of mind to new concepts. That is creative thinking. In the passage I read from Bridgman, there is a cryptic phrase that I may not understand, but it is a good and imposing phrase on which to hang an idea. He mentioned operational implications of a concept. What I have in mind is this. When a creative minded man has arrived at a clear concept, he explores its implications and inferences. He may extend the range of that concept far beyond the range of commonplace thinking. Because of the disciplined, extreme precision and penetration of his observations or experience, and his unwavering commitment to operational thinking, he may be justified in extending the range of that concept, as a mediocre thinker would not. In that way, he may break through the barriers of mental conditioning to very important conceptual creation. It is in this process of seeking the operational implications of a concept that operational thinking becomes creative thinking. From these general considerations, I shall deal with a single case of what I believe to be creative descent by means of operational thinking. It is not a new finding, but is at least 2,700 years old. I present the case not because I have made any contribution to the issue or personally have uniformly maintained a course of action in harmony with that creative descent, though I wish I could say that I have. At the risk of impropriety, I am going to take issue with a recent visitor to our campus. Since while here, he openly and vigorously expressed his view to a group of students, and since on this issue he is an orthodox follower of the prevailing national policy, while I am an irresponsible dissenter, one of the milder terms he used was starry-eyed, I do not feel that I am doing him wrong. There is a fairly general opinion, which I believe is sustained by rigorous operational thinking, that brothers, husband and wife, business partners, and intimate associates should be honest toward one another and should be justified in having full confidence in each other. The question is, how far do the sound operational implications of that concept take us? Should a man be honest so that he may be fully trusted by his next door neighbor, his employer, his employees, his fellow citizens, his country, by the world? The creative operational thinker learns somewhat by disciplined operation experiences as to when and how far he may extend operational inferences of a concept. To take an absurdly obvious case, by the process of operational thinking, it is found that 2 and 2 make 4. By inference or implication, can we trust the conclusion that 2 million and 2 million make 4 million, or must we count one by one to make sure? In the discussion with the visitor to the campus, some remarks of his led me to comment that they seemed to have a Machiavellian flavor. His answer was to the effect that Machiavelli was an able man who saw life as it is and treated it as such. Machiavellian, he said, should not be treated as a dirty word. A man in public life should know when and how to lie. He spoke of men who held the contrary view as starry-eyed. Then, of his own initiative, he brought into the conversation and spoke at some length of an incident in the administration of President Franklin D. Roosevelt. He said that during our country's entrance into the Second World War, FDR assured the country again and again and again that he never would send American boys to fight abroad. According to our visitor, FDR repeated these assertions while he was actively engaged in preparing to send troops abroad. Our visitor spoke of this course of FDR as statesmanship. Such realism, he said, enabled the president to maintain his dominant position in the country, whereby he brought about great and beneficial historic changes. In that expression, our visitor was taking a position practically identical with that of some controlling elements in our national life. For that reason, such an expression deserves consideration. As a weak and frail spokesman for those spirits who were creative dissenters on that issue, I hold that rigorous operational thinking and the operational implications of the concept presented by our visitor will not sustain the concept which he supported. It is further my opinion that our visitors and the public men's adherence to the Machiavellian policy is not the result of operational thinking and of valid operational implications of the concept, but rather is the result of long-standing and widespread social conditioning. Where such social conditioning is deep, it requires rigorous operational thinking and also rigorous examination of the operational implications of the concept to break through the extremely resistant integuments of such conditioning. There is needed such careful observation and operational thinking and such nice discernment of the operational implications of the concept as that by which Einstein transcended the Newtonian concept and brought about a profound change in human thinking. Belief in the practical necessity for dishonesty, which so dominates much of our public and private life, does not, I say, rest on critical thinking, but on continuity of ancient elements of the cultural tradition, and also, I believe, on certain genetic traits. Biological evolution has not bred honesty. Evolution uses dishonesty freely in meeting her immediate needs. Honesty is a creation of the mind and spirit of men in their descent from biological drives and in their search for inclusive and enduring values. In my opinion, rigorous operational thinking will support the aspiration of men to achieve integrity. Now, to return to practical considerations, it is my conviction that a striving for complete honesty in every phase of our national life would add immeasurably to the strength of our country at home and abroad. This would imply complete elimination of secret spying and the vast personnel of our government deliberately trained in deceit. If the world could completely trust America, there would be a great decrease in fear and a great increase in friendship. When President Eisenhower felt compelled by the conditions of his administration to lie to the world about the U-2 incident and be caught at it within a week, America must have shrunk in the respect of the world. When the succeeding administration considered it necessary to lie to the world about the Bay of Pigs incident in Cuba, our country again received a serious wound. As in public life, so in business and industry, the very large amount of solid integrity which exists is deeply injured by the widespread Machiavellian policy in other places. Fairly universal integrity in American business and industry would very greatly increase material production and would add a quality of dignity and self-respect which would be momentous. Elimination of the internal stresses of conflicting standards is wholesome for personality. One of the more significant characteristics of creative thinking and of creative dissent is the commitment to see the larger implications and inferences of positions and policies. On both large and small scale, the issue of integrity in human relations calls for rigorous operational thinking and for creative consideration of the operational implications of that concept. Here, I believe, is a vast and promising field for creative dissent. Please note that I have not intimated that general adoption of the concept I acclaim would be without perplexities in its application. Let me repeat from my quotation from Bridgman. He said, speaking of operational thinking, in some respects, that thinking becomes simpler. In other respects, however, thinking becomes more difficult because the operational implications of a concept are often very involved. For example, it is most difficult to grasp adequately all that is contained in the apparently simple concept of time and requires the continual correction of mental tendencies which we have long unquestionably accepted. Clarification of the concept of truthfulness also is difficult, beginning with distinguishing between perplexity and rationalization. However, in dealing with such a concept by operational thinking, we may break through entrenched conditioning into new concepts, and creative thinking, including creative dissent, may emerge.
We have about 5 minutes afterwards. Those who would have the time and inclination are invited to come to the front here just below stage and continue the discussion. Have we one or two questions now? Question was, you seem to say that our biological needs cause the need for dishonesty, and would you explain?
I don't know how I can do it in a minute. I might give one, anything that helps the biological process of survival is liable to be entrenched in our inheritance. Just one instance. For unsophisticated people, you folks are sophisticated, but for unsophisticated young people of 15 to 12 to 20, there is an inborn conviction that if they find a mate, the problems of life will be solved, largely. That is the one great choice to make. And they are alerted to that desire and necessity. You can discuss the matter. They have widespread experience, but a typically unsophisticated person is not touched by the reason, experience, of the world around him. There's that inner conviction that that's the major decision of his life, and he becomes very actively interested in it. And that inner feeling, that is the great decision, is biologically useful in primitive society. Now that's just a little illustration of what I mean. And we can, if I had time, I could give a wide range of cases in the animal world and otherwise where the practice of deceit is bred biologically. I don't hear too, I'll speak a little louder.
Yeah, I'm interested in your application of honesty to every decision. Would you
Well, in that particular case, I don't know the circumstances, but I, in the general field, I do know this, that the habit of physicians not telling the truth to their patients, I think just practically it is a very undesirable habit, because I see over and over again that people, they wonder, just now, what I know that he wouldn't tell me the truth, but what are the facts? I'm inclined to think that straightforwardness in informing patients of their condition, on the whole, would be a highly desirable social practice. In our early days with our physicians at Antioch here, I talked that over with them a good deal, and there was a definite policy that a student who asks us a question can depend upon our answer, that we will not deceive him for his own good, they think. That it is. I have been thinking of long-range implications of, but I think in the practical, fairly immediate implications, there's a place where we could change our habit, where the medical profession, in some respects, might change its habits. I have been pleased that with the particular physicians I have met here in Yellow Springs, that early tradition has lasted to some extent, and that we often do get honest answers to unpleasant questions.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan. You're welcome at the front afterwards if you would like to discuss in smaller groups.